We're going to be continuing our study in the book of Ecclesiastes this morning. Just a couple of things before we do. I want to thank Phil for, he always does an excellent job when he leads singing, but this morning he led some of my favorite old hymns. And I really appreciate that very much. I love many of the newer songs that we sing, but I'm afraid that we're going to lose sight of these old hymns, which teach such incredibly important lessons sometime. His yoke is easy, his burden is light. What an incredible message in that song. Rock of Ages. Boy, how many of us learned to sing in church singing Rock of Ages? What an incredible song. And it brought back a lot of memories to me. The other thing is this, though. 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and verse 15, I will sing with the spirit, I will sing with the understanding also. Rock of Ages, cleft for me. I'm almost tempted to ask how many of you know what that means. What did we mean when we sang Rock of Ages, cleft for me? And follow that up with Night of Ebon Pinion. So what is the Night of Ebon Pinion? Just a couple of things that popped into my mind, but weird things, strange things pop into my mind quite often. The book of Ecclesiastes is not helping that. Studying the book of Ecclesiastes is not helping that. For those of you who are visiting with us, we've been working our way through this book. We looked at chapter 5 last Sunday morning, and this is the conclusion that the preacher draws when he's talking about riches and wealth. Enjoy it while you can. These are my summaries of the teaching in these three verses. Verse 18, enjoy it while you can. What you have has been gifted to you by God, so be thankful for it. Verse 19, and then don't waste your time worrying about the brevity of life. Enjoy life, and don't be worried about the brevity of life. Probably if I had been writing this book, this would have been where it would have ended. Because that's one of the few positive notes that we've encountered in our study of the book of Ecclesiastes up to this point. It is the preacher who had unlimited resources, unlimited time, who could examine in the quest for the answers to life's important question, what does life mean? He could investigate every possible avenue of answering that question in a way that he calls under the sun, from the perspective of this world. And the book of Ecclesiastes basically is a journal or a diary or an account of the preacher's efforts to do exactly that. And so he says at the end of chapter 5, there are some positives that we can take from life under the sun. That positive note doesn't last very long, though, because in chapter 6, he returns back to the very oppressive, the very dark. And we have to remember again, as we're studying the book of Ecclesiastes, that he's writing from the perspective of under the sun. He's not talking about God's view. He's not talking about looking for the answer to the meaning of life from the perspective of God. Not yet. He's going to get there. He's coming to that, but not till we get to chapters 11 and 12. So he goes back to this more dark tone, this more negative tone, and I've chosen to call chapter 6 or head chapter 6 the mystery of an unfulfilled life. And in Ecclesiastes chapter 6, the preacher, again, I think Solomon very clearly, Solomon is the preacher. The preacher in Ecclesiastes chapter 6 suggest four things about the mystery of life. And I want us to think about those just briefly in our lesson this morning. And the first one really kind of is a carryover from what we talked about last Sunday morning in chapter 5. And that is, riches do not satisfy. And so he says, and this is the English Standard rendering of this passage, there is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous evil. This is vanity. That's a favorite expression of the preacher as he's trying to find satisfaction. He's trying to find purpose He's trying to find meaning in life. So here's a man, he says, who has everything from a material standpoint, everything that he could possibly want. Wealth, possessions, and honor. Doesn't lack anything of all that he desires. But then the preacher uses an expression, and this is the English Standard Version rendering of this, it is a grievous evil. He used that expression a couple of times in chapter 5. I think verse 13 in chapter 5 was the first time that he used it. This is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. He uses it again in verse 16 of chapter 5. This is also a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go, and what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? And now here's a third grievous evil. And the grievous evil, it is prominent. It is significant. The English Standard Version renders it, it lies heavy on mankind. The New American Standard says it is prevalent among men. I think what the preacher's saying here is this grievous evil is common among people. It's not unique. It's not unusual. It's not just a few people who experience something like this or something similar to this. It is widespread. And the evil that he talks about again is this man has everything that he could possibly want from a material standpoint, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them. And I thought about the significance of that. What does it mean when he says God does not give him the power to enjoy them? Could be a lot of things that could be referencing. It could be that he just doesn't have the disposition to enjoy them. It could be that he doesn't have the character to enjoy them. It could be that he doesn't have the time to enjoy them. I really think maybe that's more likely what the preacher's talking about. We see this illustrated at the very least a lot. If you've ever attended a funeral, you know, you attend a funeral, here's someone who has died, and at this funeral, the funeral parlor, the funeral home, the chapel, wherever the funeral's being held, is filled with beautiful flowers. But the person who's being honored doesn't get any benefit from those flowers at all. And people stand around and they say nice things about the person who's died. The person who's gone doesn't hear those things and doesn't get the benefit of those things. We see that kind of thing happen. And the conclusion, or the last thing that the preacher says about it, is about all this material wealth that this person has accumulated. A stranger enjoys them. We have very little control. All those things that we accumulate during the course of a lifetime. What happens to those things when you're gone? I know we like to think we have total control over those things. We can write a will and we can say, here's how all of my material possessions are going to be distributed, and here's how they're all going to be used. There is a sense in which that's so. But at the end of the day, when we die, our possessions, the wealth, the power, the honor, all of those things go to somebody else. It all belongs to somebody else. And so the preacher is reminding us what he's told us in some detail in chapter 5 is if you're looking for satisfaction, if you're looking for fulfillment in life, if I could just get enough things, if I could just make enough money, you are going to be seriously and sadly disappointed. It just doesn't happen. And again, if this is Solomon, we're talking about perhaps the richest man who has ever lived on the face of the planet, telling us that riches do not satisfy. Not only that, but in verses 3 through 6, he tells us long life does not satisfy. He says, if a man fathers 100 children and lives many years so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Talking about the stillborn child. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good. And then he says, almost as an afterthought, do not all go to one place. I'll comment about that in just a second. But he tells a sad story here, really contrasts two human beings. He contrasts the man who lives many years. He grows to be an old man. And he fathers many children, fathers 100 children. You know, we think about how hard it is to keep up with 2 or 3 or 4. He fathers 100 children. But he's not satisfied with life, Solomon says. When he dies, he doesn't even get a proper burial. And at the end of the day, Solomon says, the preacher says he doesn't have any rest. And then you have the stillborn child, who never has a chance to accomplish anything. Please understand, please remember that this is being written from the standpoint of life under the sun. From the standpoint of the world. So here's a man who has everything he could ever want. He lives a long life. He fathers many children. And here's a child who never gets a chance to experience anything in life at all. The preacher says, which of the two is better off? Clearly, the preacher says, it is the child who died at birth. Who has rest, he says. That isn't provided for the person. Again, we're looking at the perspective of life under the sun. He has everything that his heart desires, but he doesn't have any satisfaction. He doesn't find any peace. He doesn't find any rest. He goes on to say, even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good. I said this last week when we were talking about chapter 5. I think this is true. I don't think it's hyperbole. I don't think it's an overstatement. I don't think it's any kind of an exaggeration really at all. Some of the most miserable people on the face of the planet right now are the wealthiest people. On the face of the planet. Some of the most miserable people in this world today are some of the most powerful people in the world today. Which is exactly what the preacher is telling us in the book of Ecclesiastes. Here's a man who lives long and fathers many children, and he doesn't find any satisfaction in life at all. The stillborn child, he says, is better than him. And then he asks a rhetorical question which almost seems to demand an affirmative answer. Do not all go to one place? You know, we know that that's not true. The answer to that is no. We know that the answer to that question is no. But how do we know that? You know, does everybody who dies go to one place? If somebody were to ask you that question, just take it out of the context of Ecclesiastes. And somebody were to ask you the question, does everybody who dies go to one place? You would say, well, certainly not. We know that. How do we know that? Because we can see a perspective that's not under the sun. We can see a perspective from beyond the sun. God has revealed His will to us. And God has shown us that not everybody who dies goes to the same place. But again, the preacher is looking just at life from under the sun. And just looking at it from that perspective, the wealthiest man who ever lived, who lives for 2,000 years twice over, fathers 100 children, what happens to him eventually? He dies. Same thing exactly that happened to the stillborn child. There is no satisfaction in long life. There is no satisfaction in long. I can't wait till we get to Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and see the word picture, the incredible, it's a brilliant word picture that Solomon paints in Ecclesiastes chapter 12 about what it means to grow old. And just heads up, if you're not familiar with that, he doesn't paint a picture that you would call the golden years. Far from it. So, long life doesn't satisfy. Number 3, when you move on to verse 7. And, you know, I really wrestled all week with how to word this. This is the best I could come up with. Satisfaction doesn't satisfy. Satisfaction doesn't satisfy. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. What does the preacher mean? All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. First of all, I think to help us understand that, it's important to know that the word that's translated appetite in verse 7 is translated soul in verses 2 and 3. And so in verse 2, a man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. This is a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children so that the days of his years are not, the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's goods, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. It's the same word, translated appetite in verse 7, translated soul earlier in the chapter. So what is he talking about here, right? And, you know, what does he mean when he says all of the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied? Well, and this popped into my mind, especially because Thanksgiving is coming up, and Thanksgiving is some of our favorite holiday. You know, our mouths are watering already thinking about and the turkey's okay, but the dressing and all the, you know, all the fixings, the things that come with it. And, you know, you'll go to your grandmother's house, or you'll go to your mother's house, or you'll get together with your brothers and sisters, you'll get together with family, friends, and you will eat this incredibly large meal. And that will do you for the rest of your life, right? Your appetite will be satisfied forever. You will never need to eat anything again. Listen, you will be hungry the next day. I don't care how much you eat on Thursday. You will get up on Friday thinking about turkey sandwiches, you know, leftover dressing, hoping that the nephews didn't take all the mashed potatoes. You'll be hoping, you'll be hoping that there's some food left. You'll be hungry again. That's what Solomon is saying. You know, you go to great trouble you toil to get what you need. All the toil of man is for his mouth. But it doesn't satisfy. It doesn't fulfill. And the reason for that, and again, it's not the preacher's intention to reveal the end now. He's coming to that in chapters 11 and 12. But I tell you what I think about, when I think about verse 7, I think about this, that C.S. Lewis said that if we have a longing for something that we can't find in this world, if we have an appetite for something that we can't find in this world, in other words, then does that not imply that there's another world, there's something beyond this world? And I think that's exactly the point. The very first beatitude: blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. What we're really looking for, when we're looking for the answer to the meaning of life, what everybody is looking for, whether they know it or not, whether they understand it or not, whether they would express it like this, what they're looking for is, they're looking for fulfillment of the soul. They're looking for satisfaction of the soul. And Jesus said that comes when we are poor in spirit. And what happens when we are poor in spirit? What happens when we come to understand and recognize that we need something that this physical world can't provide for us? We will then, Jesus said, hunger and thirst for what? Hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. We want to be happy. Isn't that what everybody wants? We want to be fulfilled. We want to be satisfied. And Solomon is saying you can't find that under the sun. It's just not there. I think, brethren, even those of us who are Christians wrestle with this. You know, being confused, being misled by Satan into thinking that satisfaction comes under the sun. If I just had the right relationship, I would be satisfied. If I just had enough money, I would be satisfied. If I just had enough knowledge, we'll talk about that in a moment, I would be satisfied. That's all I would need in the world. We get caught up in that kind of thinking. We're not immune from that kind of thinking at all. Again, the problem with all of that is all the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. You can't fulfill that longing of the soul with anything that exists under the sun. It just is not there. And so, number four, in verse 8, advantages do not satisfy. Solomon says, "For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living?" Now, I'm going to say something with fear and trembling right now. And the reason is because we have in our presence this morning a barrister who is, I'm sure, skilled in constitutional law. But I will say that all men are created equal is a myth. Now, you know, all men are created equal from the standpoint of all deserve equal treatment under the law. certain inalienable rights, I get that. But it's not true, it never has been true, that all men are created equal. Some people are born with just native intelligence. I'd like to know how that feels. Some people are just smarter than other people. Some people are born into an environment of wealth and comfort. Some people are born into an environment of abject poverty. And those are situations that we have sometimes very little or no control over at all. Some people are born and live in places where they are relatively warm and safe and full and comfortable. Some people are born and live in places where they don't have any of those advantages at all. It is not true that all men are created equal, and that's exactly the point that the preacher is making in verse 8. What advantage has the wise man over the fool? At the end of the day, they both die. And by the way, being wise, being a wise man, having degrees, having an incredible fund or storehouse of intellectual knowledge doesn't guarantee that a woman is going to be a good mother, does it? Doesn't guarantee that a man is going to be a good father. Doesn't guarantee that those people are going to be a good spouse. As a matter of fact, it might even be a disadvantage sometimes in some of those situations. At the end of the day, I don't know who the wisest person in the world would be. I don't know who the wisest person in this room is, but I do know this. God allowing the world to stand long enough, the smartest, the wisest, the most intelligent person in this room is going to die, just like the rest of us. Just like the rest of us. I don't know who the richest person in this room is. I'd kind of like to know. I'd like to get to know you better. I don't know who the poorest person in this room is in regard to material things, but I know this, God allowing the world to stand long enough, the richest person in this room will die, just like the poorest person in this room. And so Solomon says, again, the preacher says, what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? That's confusing. The last part of that verse is confusing. I'd like to think that what the preacher is saying is the poor man has manners. The poor man knows how to treat other people with respect. Now, I thought about asking some of you who are servers. You serve people. You know, I didn't. And it would be a generalization, but which category of people are the most likely to mistreat you when you're trying to serve them food? The humble person, the poor person? Is that person the one who's the... And again, that's a generalization. I know that doesn't work. But the poor man who knows how to conduct himself before the living, he's a good person at the very least, Solomon is saying. He doesn't have any money. He doesn't have any advantages. But that's the whole point. Advantages don't make any difference under the sun. Advantages don't make any difference under the sun. The poor are likely to be more content, happier than those who accumulate vast riches. So, with those four things in mind, what conclusions does the preacher draw? This is verses 9 through 12. What conclusions does he draw? Here's the first one. Be content with what you have. And stop worrying about the future. Don't waste your time dreaming about an uncertain future. Verse 9, better is the sight of the eyes. And again, I think what he's saying is better is what you have now. You've got it. You can see it. Than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. The grass is always greener on the other side. Have you ever heard that before? I wonder how many marriages have been destroyed because rather than a woman looking at her husband, what she sees with her eyes, what she has, that relationship that she has, and valuing that, and appreciating that, and revering that, looks for something else, looks for something better. The wandering of the appetite, in the English Standard Version, the preacher calls it. I wonder how many people have trouble sleeping at night because they're worried about what they don't have. I don't have enough money. I don't have a big enough house. I don't have a nice enough car. I don't have nice enough clothes. I don't have all of those. And we worry about those things. And we fret and wonder, how are we going to get those things? The wandering appetite, rather than getting on our knees at night and thanking God for all the incredible things that we do have. You see the difference? Be content with what you have, rather than wasting time dreaming about an uncertain future. Number two, trying to find satisfaction in the gaining of new knowledge is a lesson in futility. This is a dangerous point to be making with a group of college students in the audience. But that's exactly what the preacher says. Whatever has come to be has already been named. And it is known what man is. And what he is not able to dispute. And that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words... Boy, and getting this late in the semester, you guys are really feeling this, aren't you? The more words, the more vanity. And what advantage is there to man? You know, let's assume that you could accumulate all of the knowledge that existed on the face of the planet. This man did that to a higher degree probably than any other human being that's ever lived. He asked God for wisdom, and God baptized him in wisdom, immersed him in wisdom. And he says, the more I know, the more I realize I don't know. There's a song that Bob Dylan wrote. Bob Dylan is one of the troubadours, the chroniclers of my youth. And the last line of the chorus is, I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. If you listen to the words of the song, what he's saying is, when I was young, I thought I knew everything. The older I get, the more I realize how much I don't know. That's exactly what Solomon is saying. The more words, the more vanity. And what purpose does it serve? Is there satisfaction in that? Are you going to find the answer to the meaning of life? Are you going to find the answer to life's most important questions by just accumulating wisdom? It's not there, is it? It's not there. And so he says then in verse 12, spending your life in a search for the meaning of life. And again, we're talking about under the sun, is also a lesson in futility. He illustrates that by asking two questions in verse 12. First question is this: who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime? You know, we all think we do, don't we? No, we think we know what's good for us. We know what's good for us. Who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime? And he asks a second question: who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? Do you think our grandparents could ever have dreamed of something like this on the screen? Do you think our grandparents could ever have dreamed of a car that pulls into the parking lot and it makes no noise at all except the sound that the tires make on the pavement because it's running on some other kind of power? You think our grandparents, our great-grandparents, would ever have dreamed that a human being would set foot on the moon? Who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? And what is his answer to both of those questions? He will pass like a shadow. He will pass like a shadow. While he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow. You think you know what's good for you in this life? You're going to die. You think you know what's coming? You're going to die. The point he's making is this life is not long enough to answer either question. This life is not long enough to answer either question, so you're wasting, we're wasting valuable time when we search for the meaning of life in that way. I've got just a minute or two. Let me suggest to you, I've been saying, I think in just about every lesson, I think the preacher is Solomon. This chapter is one of the reasons why I think that this is Solomon, or why I become even more convinced that this is Solomon. Look at the portrait that we get of the preacher in chapter 6. He was given riches, wealth, and honor. Or he talks about someone who was given riches, wealth, and honor, but he left it all in the end to a stranger, to a foreigner. That's exactly what happened to Solomon. Fathered 100 children and lived many years, but lacks a satisfied soul. That's a pretty good figurative description of Solomon, is it not? Partook of all that he desired. That's the whole point of the book of Ecclesiastes. He tried everything he wanted to try, and he couldn't find any satisfaction. He knew it all. But what did he conclude? That it wasn't worth knowing. It wasn't worth knowing. I have accumulated all of this knowledge. I've accumulated all this wisdom. And it didn't satisfy. It wasn't really worth knowing. Lived the ultimate life only to realize that it was over. Where is Solomon now? Where is the richest man who ever lived on the face of the planet? Where is the wisest man, Solomon, who ever lived on the face of the planet? He's dead and gone. And by the way, we don't generally remember Solomon very fondly, do we? I don't think I've ever heard anyone say, you know, in my list of Bible heroes, Solomon is at the top of the list, or Solomon is even on the list. I don't know that I've ever heard anybody. You know, we put David there. David committed some egregious sins, but he humbled himself and asked for forgiveness. And even after he committed those sins, he was still called a man after God's own heart. Abraham made some big mistakes, but, you know, Joseph, I mean, we have this list of Bible characters. Who would put Solomon on that list? I don't know anybody who would. He understands that. If he's the author of this book, before he died, he came to understand that everything meant all that that he had, all the riches that he had, all the power that he had, all the long life that he had, all the children that he had, that none of that meant anything. That none of that meant anything. That was not important. I hope it was Solomon who wrote the book of Ecclesiastes because of the conclusion that he's going to draw. And that's the conclusion that we'll draw at the end of this lesson this morning, and that is the emptiness of a life without God. Where do we find satisfaction? Where do we find what fills the soul, satisfies the soul? We find it with God. The whole duty of man, he will say, by the time we get to the end of this incredible book, fear God and keep His commandments. You have on the screen, I think, an incredibly important insight into the life of maybe the only human being other than Jesus who ever lived who could tell us these things with absolute authority. This is Solomon's journal, if you will, Solomon's diary, if you will. The only question then is, will we learn from his mistakes? Will we learn from his lessons? Will we seek for fulfillment in a relationship with God? We never close or conclude a service like this without extending the invitation, offering the invitation of God to those who might need to be in the audience, those who are in the audience who might need to respond to God's invitation to become a Christian. Search for the meaning of life in the only place where you can find the right answers. And the answers that really work, and that is in a relationship with God. Confess your faith that Jesus is God's Son, Lord, and Christ. Repent of your sins. Be baptized into Christ for the remission of sins. And then dedicate yourself to seeking after God. Honoring God, glorifying God, worshiping God in spirit and in truth. Can we help you in any way respond to the invitation this morning? If we can, while we sing the words to this song, if you have some spiritual need with which we could assist you, please come down to one of these front seats and let us know how.